This New Year's week on Art of the Air features a return visit with nonprofit executive Alan Harrison discussing his new follow-up book, Scene Change 2, about nonprofit arts boards. Next, retired design and art director Norbert Shimkus sharing his work as a gifted ceramic artist. Our spotlights on Valparaiso Creative Council's new Artist Hub with executive director Jessica Corral.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, WVLP, 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Art on the Air is heard every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Also heard on Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Media. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. We'd like to welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight. She's been with us several times before, and she actually wears many hats in the arts department. But she's going to be speaking to us about the Valpo Creative Council and some exciting things they have going on down in Valparaiso. Some events, but also a brand new project that's just come up. She's going to share with us. That's Jessica Corral, who's the executive director there at Valpo Creative Council. Welcome back to Art in the Air Spotlight.
Aloha, Jessica.
Hi, Esther. Hi, Larry. Always a joy for you guys to have me and to talk with you, catch up a bit.
Well, tell us about this brand new project that's, in fact, I just read the article where you just got the key to the front door of the building, but tell us all about that.
Yeah, well, if, for those of you that don't know, Valparaiso Creative Council is, you know, the roots of that is really the community demanding that there be a creative district designed and developed within downtown Valpo. So it's been since about 2017 inception and creatively just kind of morphing each year with what are we defined as, what do we look like, kind of in embryonic stages for the past 5 years. But I want to declare that we're in toddler stage. We're getting our feet underneath us. We're learning to walk. And the building's really going to be that transition period into that next stage. And it's going to allow us to basically have a place where people can come see us. You know, we've been working from the cloud, having events, promoting the arts, having different programming. But this allows us to have, you know, community members come to us and say, hey, who really are you? Let me check out your space, which is really exciting. So yeah, the key handoff was fun, Larry.
Well, that's great. And so tell us some of the things that VCC has done so far. I'm aware of it because I was able to exhibit with you guys, but tell us about like the thing for artists and for art patrons.
Yeah, you were able to exhibit with us and serve as a board member for a nice amount of time, especially during the growth period when we were defining who we are. So yeah, we do have quarterly exhibits that are featured at Roots Cafe in Lower Lincoln. That's going to continue through 2025. So we're going to be doing a it's really important for anybody that wants to get information from us to send us an email at info@valpocreates.org. I'm going to be putting together a call out for artists. It's going to outline everything that's coming up in 2025 and what people can get involved in, no matter what type of art, wherever your talent lies. But aside from that, the quarterlies really allow us to just partner up with businesses, bring the art into their spaces, and also do a reception called Art and Innovation on a quarterly basis, where we bring in somebody to educate or somebody to speak about their business and their art form, or panelists. Last time we had leadership from the city, the county, and the state. And so those are just an opportunity for the quarterlies for sure. Great for anybody in the area that's an artist.
So Jessica, you talked about 2017, and I think I might be referring maybe to 2017, maybe a little before, but was that the building? And when I saw the image of your building, was that the building, like, was that at the root of everything? There were like artist events there a long time ago with, because I remember Jade was there with Pieces of Jade, and you could pre-support the artist, and then there was like an event that, is this sounding familiar at all?
No, and you know what?
Okay,
I think so, that was BCC related, but if anything was used in that building, there's a lot of historic, I found out and even touched base with Kevin at Poco Muse, that there's a lot of history of talented artistry all the way back to the 1890s. And so that whole area or row was actually where all the manufacturers and creators and blacksmiths and all of the just rich history of hand makers, right, was right. All along that corridor and that avenue right there. So no, this will be our first time ever being in a building. We've never had a location before. So it's a huge first step for us, for sure.
So what are those first steps? What's happening right now today?
Sure. Yeah, we have four different sections inside the building. Each one is kind of designated for different usage. So we have some arts organizations that are going to be housed within the space. They get to use it for their own purposes. And then we also have an artist hub on one side of it that's going to be giving artists access to making their own work inside a space, storing their projects there. Instead of having it be something at home that they do, we can create a kind of artistry hub. And then we'll also have a conference room, an office space for VCC to conduct our service and our board meetings. So right now it's just the bare minimum of taking a space that probably needed updates since the 70s, revamping it, opening it up to the public. And that's phase one. Phase two has a lot more involved, and that'll come later down the line, probably in about a year or so.
So you're going to have any gallery space there too? Is that going to be part of what you're going to have there?
No, not at all. We're not competing with anybody in the area that's doing that. The Valpo Artists Guild is doing such a great job themselves. And so they're right directly across the street from us. We want to bridge that gap and maybe do some networking and have pop-up events with each other. So no, we're not looking to duplicate that in any kind of way. What we're doing is going to be a new artist thumbprint for downtown Valpo that doesn't exist yet. So the details on that will kind of unfold as we develop this out further.
You mentioned having places for people to work. Will you have specific hours, or will they have keys to certain areas where they could work at their, you know, at their own pace?
Yeah, great question, Esther. No, that they'll have access to the doors. We'll have key fobs that they'll be able to access certain rooms at certain times, and we'll have a schedule so that everything can kind of rotate out. And since we haven't done this before, just learning as we go. So we're going to start small. So we're going to be doing a call out for artists. We'll probably have five as an initial starting point. Anybody that wants to support that, November 22nd is our last official day for this campaign. And anybody who does donate, it gets matched by the IHCDA. And anyone who donates $250 gets their name on our official founders wall, which is a huge perk if you want to be a supporter.
Excellent. That's Jessica Corral, Valpo Creative Council's Executive Director, telling us about the new art space. Jessica, thank you so much for coming on Art in the Air Spotlight.
Yeah, congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Art in the Air Spotlight and the complete one-hour program on Lakeshore Public Media is brought to you by McCauley Real Estate in Valparaiso, Olga Patrician, Senior Broker. And as a reminder, if you'd like to have your event on Art in the Air Spotlight or have a longer feature interview, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck, BRECH.com.
This is Peter Marks, former theater critic of the Washington Post, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
We are happy to welcome back Alan Harrison to Art on the Air. Alan is a writer and speaker specializing in nonprofit arts organizations, strategy, and life politics. His blog posts appear regularly in major publications, including Arts Journal. For 30 years, he has explored the relationships between the arts and community on behalf of nonprofit arts organizations across the United States. Previously, we spoke about his book, Scene Changed, Why Today's Nonprofit Arts Organizations Have to Stop Producing Art and Start Producing Impact. Today we are here to discuss his new book, Scene Change 2, The Five Real Responsibilities of Nonprofit Arts Boards. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Alan. It's very nice to see you again.
Aloha. And mahalo for having me.
Aloha.
Well, Alan, we're so great to have you back on and with the release of your new book. And I know Esther and I both enjoyed it. In fact, we talked off air about some of the impacts it has on boards that we have served on. And I see some things. But just briefly, I mean, people can go back to our January 12th or 14th on Lakeshore to hear your previous interview with us. But maybe just to recap briefly your biography, which I find very fascinating, some of the things, and then we'll get into the new book.
Well, I've worked for 30, again, Esther mentioned it, about 30 years in the nonprofit arts industry in various roles. I marketed, I was a development director. I was an executive director for 15 years. I was a managing director in a partnership, a lot of things like that. And and never forget, I was on Jeopardy in 2018.
Right.
And I was a champion, so I won twice. But no, seriously, I've been working with these groups for years. I always thought there was something nagging and wrong. And over the last dozen years or so, what I've really noticed happening and there are consequences because of it, of turning into arts organizations closing down, is that they're really, most arts organizations, I wish I could say, you know, most arts organizations didn't do this, but actually they do this kind of art for art's sake mission, which really has nothing to do with the community they're serving. They're rushing, as I put it somewhere in the book, into an elitist whirlpool of irrelevance. And that is because, or one of the outcomes of that is that donors are donating to arts organizations so that donors may attend. So if the donor is the beneficiary, that is the textbook definition of elitism. And so that has to stop in order for the nonprofit arts organizations to prove any kind of essential quality to their communities. There are some, happily, wonderful arts organizations that do use the community's needs as their starting point. And they talk to the people within their community and say, what do you need? Never what do you want, just what do you need? And they say, and then they use the arts as somehow a tool to make that happen. The perfect example is the Louisville Orchestra in Louisville, Kentucky, which is not very far from you. And they only do 17 performances in their great big scary Whitney Hall. And I say scary because a lot of these buildings are built to look somewhat like prisons. only 17, that's it for the year, but they do 250 performances around the state of Kentucky in every county in the state. And they never charge for those tickets. They perform in high school gyms, in libraries, in rec centers, outside. They played at Mammoth Cave with Yo-Yo Ma. It's quite an experience to see the people, and they play Kentucky's music for Kentuckians. So they'll not only play the classical canon, but they'll also bring in, say, a bluegrass band from Kentucky, or a jazz band or a combo or something. And they'll play together so that you have jazz with a full orchestra, a Grammy Award-winning orchestra right behind them. It's quite the experience. At these concerts, you don't have people sitting back in their seats and clapping politely. You have people standing and dancing in the aisle. Yes. But beyond that, they're bridging the divide between the urban and the rural populations of Kentucky, which have been at odds with each other for years and years and years. And they all come together and they all learn what they're about through the music. The music brings them together to begin with, and then they start the discussions about making a better life. So that's what arts organizations are supposed to be doing, that kind of thing.
What you just said, Alan, makes me think that that community is actually listening to what the community is saying, because bland experiences are not inspiring. And so if they are doing things that are interesting, then they're going to get the engagement for the people they want to have the works presented in front of.
That's right. And it's exactly right. And it makes them excited to be there. And they're dressed.
Right.
And
involved.
One performance I went to, I embedded with them for about a month. And one performance I went to was in a rural high school with a domed gym, the worst possible acoustics right. for an orchestra, hard surfaces everywhere. And I'm telling you, these people, they look like they just came off the job. I mean, I saw men and women with blue denim chambray work shirts with mud on them. So, I mean, I know they just got off work. And they bring their families, and they came, and the families may be dressed in their Sunday best, but they're all jumping around and dancing, the old ones, the young ones, they're clog dancing to the music. It's something you would never see at another kind of orchestra concert. And the music is brilliant. It is, as I say, they won the Grammy Award last year. So it behooves the people to it just gives them a little bit of push that say, okay, this is not just a local orchestra. Oh, there's nothing wrong with a local orchestra. This is actually a national mover on the scene. But if you ask them about it, if you ask the Louisville Orchestra, Teddy Abrams, the conductor, and Graham Parker, the executive, if you ask them both why they're doing this, they'll say, we're doing this for them. We're not doing this for us.
In your first book, you had a great example, and I don't know if that was Louisville or some other orchestra, that they were looking at their funding, and then they went out into the community and played like for homeless people, but they also brought social services. Maybe expand on that again. I found that a fascinating example.
It was a great program. I have to tell you, the orchestra is kaput, but It doesn't matter. They did the right thing when they were alive. Closing down is not a, there's no value judgment to that. As somebody once told me, every Broadway show that has ever opened has closed, right. except for the ones that happen to be running right now.
Yeah.
And, or if you look at it in more of a macro thing, every 99.9% of the animals that have ever existed on the planet Earth are extinct. The rest are alive right now. So there's no shame in closing down as long as you're doing the right work while you're open. While they were open, one of the programs they did was they went to underpasses, into tent cities and homeless communities. They brought either an octet or 16. It wasn't ever more than that. Usually a lot of brass and a lot of microphones at work there, because it's really loud under an overpass. And they would perform for the homeless people, the unhoused people under those overpasses, by bringing chairs. They brought bottles of water for everybody. They had social service entities with them who sat among them and coaxed them out of the tents, because there's a trust issue, and they played for them. And at the break, the same social service people were saying, now, what do you need? Do you need a new set of clothes? Do you need a haircut, a shave? What is it that you want? You want to take a shower? I can hook you up with all of those things. Do you need to fill out paperwork for Section 8 housing? Something like that. And the results were amazing. Is that normally in an unhoused camp like that, maybe 5% will find housing ultimately. This group, it was 20%. And the old saw that some people still stick to, and it's about the worst, again, elitist thing to say, is that, these people don't want to find homes. They want to be homeless. Nobody wants to be homeless. Not one person wants to be homeless. Get that out of your head right now. It's not true. I don't know who's telling you this, but they're wrong. So in this case, here they are. They're doing good works for the community. They're using music as the play, as the way to bring them out of the tents. And then suddenly they're, they've got apartments, and they may be going back to work and then contributing taxes back to the community. And it becomes a virtual cycle that was remarkable. I hope somebody else picks it up. It was in the Bay Area.
Right. Now, in your first book, and then we'll get on to your second book, it kind of like teed up, I think, the issues. I mean, it really did that. So identify some of the things that are in your first book, because these books are connected. You really, they both stand alone. I mean, you could pick up your new book and it will stand alone fine. But the first book really clearly identifies some of the issues. But maybe go over those once again for our audience.
Well, Scene Change laid out the problem. and that lays out this toxicity problem, this irrelevance problem, this idea that arts organization, nonprofit arts organizations, have never read the IRS statute for nonprofit organizations. It's called 501c3 because that's the statute in the IRS code, section 501, subsection 3, subsection C, subsection 3. And it's really short. It's like four sentences. It's nothing. And yet, every time I speak to a group of nonprofit arts leaders, and I do it often, it's the first question I give them. How many of you have ever read section 501c3 of the IRS code? And at most, it's 10%. And it just infuriates me because, well, I don't know, if you were sending a balloon up in the air, wouldn't you want to know how the thing works before you climb into the basket? The arts are never mentioned in Section 501c3 as a tax-exempt activity, and that is not an oversight. It's on purpose. The reason it's not is because art by itself has been deemed, art is essential. Artists are magical because they can take disparate things and put together art. Arts organizations are neither essential nor magical. Art and artists will exist before they existed before there were nonprofit arts organizations, and they'll exist after all of them have closed down. The point is that for a nonprofit arts organization to become indispensable, it has a duty. It has signed a document that says we are responsive to the community, not to the art. We use art as a tool to make life better. They've actually signed paperwork that says that, or else they wouldn't have gotten the 501c3 in the first place. Once they get the 501c3, the truth is the IRS is never going to come after them and say, you know, you're not doing your duty, because they don't have enough people. But that's not the reason to do unethical work. That's a way to get around. And very rarely, and it takes a lot of effort to close down a nonprofit organization of any kind for not doing its work. The one that comes to mind is a foundation, a family foundation that was in New York that was clearly not doing anything for its communities and, in fact, was pocketing the money, which is one of the first rules. You can't accept any of the money. And that was, what was the name of that foundation again? It was run by this this orange-faced guy who... that was it, that foundation. And so they actually closed down. But do you know how much money and how many court dates it took for that to happen, even though they were blatantly messing up and blatantly profiting from their own foundation? It took years. So imagine that they're not going to come after a little nonprofit arts organization if it's not doing the work. That said, if you're not doing the work, you shouldn't be a nonprofit arts organization. Go ahead and be a commercial one is what I've said right in both books. There's no shame in it. In fact, there's no moral high ground to running a nonprofit. There are just different responsibilities attached. And it's easy to start a for-profit arts organization. People do it all the time. And I don't just mean Broadway or something like that. Small companies. There's a company that I was talking to in Philadelphia. For-profit, because it allows them to really concentrate on their art. If people want to buy the art, that's great. If they don't, oh well. That's what they're measuring their progress on, not how good people's lives get.
Alan, were you piggyback writing? I can see you writing scene change with your left hand and scene change two with your right hand at the same time.
Originally, I thought I would put the two ideas together into one book. And when I put it out there, there were two things that happened. One, it was incredibly long. And then the second part is that I noticed that there weren't any books on board members, and I wanted to do more research on board members before I wanted them to get this book. There are really very few books on how to be a board member for an arts organization. It's me and Michael Kaiser and a little bit of Richard Ingram. Richard Ingram wrote a really good book called 10 Important Responsibilities for Nonprofit Board Members, all kinds of nonprofits. And it's a very dry but accurate depiction of the very specific responsibilities of boards, not arts boards, because the assumption in Richard Ingram's book is that you're in the art, you're in a nonprofit organization because there was a need in your community and you're trying to solve or mitigate the problems. The issue with the arts organizations is that there is no, for the most part, there are no such people who are doing it. There are some who are doing great work. And you know what? As I write about this in Arts Journal every week, the letters I get, the people who think I'm coming down on them for not doing it, they're the ones almost every time who are said, well, why are you complaining about it? I mean, look what I do. My organization helps, you know, feed people in this corner and helps clothe people over here. And we do, we serve as the in-house art, music and dance departments for our schools. And my response is, isn't it always the way that the one who's actually doing the work is the one who's feeling put upon? You're doing great work. You know, keep it up. But for the most part, no, that's not happening. And so it's my intention for board members to buy this book, which has been, I hammerlocked the publisher to make this second book really affordable. It's under $12 a copy. And that's just the list price. There are even places where you can get it cheaper than that if you order a certain amount. But I really wanted people to buy 20 for their board or 10 for their board or 5 for their board. It was never my intention that, for example, in the first book or the second book, that these were textbooks. And yet I'm hearing from arts administration leaders, teachers, professors, and such, who are now using these books in their own classroom alongside the more dry books that are out there. This is what they're telling you to do, but this is what's really happening. Alan will tell you what's really happened. And because they're easy to read and they're kind of fun and funny in times and a little more self-revealing than I probably had intended, they needed to be two books. So hence Scene Change and Scene Change 2.
Most of us are asked to be on a board and we're just swimming in there not knowing what it actually means. You know, we might have done a piece of work that was interesting and then all of a sudden we're on an arts education board. And so this really, you know, it is a primer.
Well, yeah. Well, there are a couple of things, reasons why. I did a research project in between the two books where I sent I did a survey with 600 board members of nonprofit arts organizations who answered anyway. And I asked them, what's your most important responsibility to the organization? What's your board's single most important responsibility to the organization? And then what is the one responsibility that the board is currently lacking? And it was three questions and I limited them to 6 words apiece so that they wouldn't go off on a, you know, on a story. And also so it was more easy to categorize. They have no idea why they're there. They mentioned fundraising and they mentioned governance. Fundraising to them, when I did some qualitative research later, turned into, well, they want me to write a check, which is, I mean, that's great, but that's not what fundraising is. And then governance, they just use the word because somebody told them.
Right.
It doesn't really mean anything to them. So I created this, and over the years, I've created a lot of rules for board meetings and such. One of the most important ones, and I write about it in here, is that if you know that you're spending a lot of money on a meeting, and in this case, if you took every board member and everyone who's sitting in your board meeting room and you decided just they were $100 an hour consultants, and if there were 20 people in there, that's $2,000 an hour that you're paying on consulting fees. They're in-kind donations, essentially, but that's still $2,000 an hour. If you're spending, let's say your meeting is 2 hours long, that's $4,000. Let's say you have 10 meetings a year, that's $40,000. Do you want to spend $40,000 talking about the past, things that are unchangeable? Or do you want to talk about the future? So my sense is that if people took board meetings and only talked about the future, instead of rehashing an executive director's report, which is the purpose of which is to talk about what's going on and the past, let that sit by itself, then you'll be far more productive in the long run. And so I created some rules. Everybody follows Robert's Rules of Order. It was started by a military man. It is not it's a great way to stifle innovation and conversation. It's more than just guardrails on a conversation that can go out of out of hand. So I have my own set of rules in here, Harrison's rules of order, which I'll just say the first one, which is on this topic, which is don't waste the money you've budgeted for board meetings by talking about things you cannot change. Mm-hmm. So there are several other rules to follow, but they're all very much common sense ways to get your organization to stop concentrating on financial results as some sort of way to the future, but instead looking at your impact. For nonprofit organizations, all nonprofit organizations, including and perhaps especially the arts, the coin of the realm is not the money. Your financial bottom line is fine, but that is incidental. Your impact, as you measure it, is what you're measuring. It's not a for-profit company. It doesn't matter how much money you're making or losing, but I would rather have a company lose money and create a ton of impact than the other way around, to be running in the black, and then, you know, but we really didn't do anything this year to help anybody. So, and I think that I'm not alone. The public wants this too. Your community wants this, and that's the key. Ask them for, you know, what's wrong, and then make it possible to help it. Help solve these and mitigate these issues.
Well, in our final minute, we want to let you have the opportunity to tell people when and how your book will be available, Scene Change 2, and also about how they can reach out to you for your blog and information and things like that.
Sure. So to contact me, and I hope you will, because people have not been shy about doing so. So do that. My email address, and I know it's silly, but it's Alan, A-L-A-N, at 501c3.guru, which is also 501c3.guru is my own personal website. But you can read my stuff every week on artsjournal.com, which is an incredible aggregate of arts stories from around the world. And they've asked me to be a blogger every week. As far as the books are concerned, Scene Change is available now in every bookstore. Just ask for it. And if they don't have it, they'll order it for you. Scene Change 2 was made available on December 10th in the UK, December 17th in the US. So it's available as well. If you order it right now and get it, you know, get them both. If you haven't gotten the first, you really should get the first and then get the second. And that's not me trying to make money on it. I don't make money off of these books, but it will make much more sense to you if you get Scene Change and then Scene Change 2. And then pick up a whole bunch of Scene Change 2s for your board members because they don't know why they're there.
Right. Well, Alan, I appreciate that. Both books are really spoke to me, and being a board chair on Lakeshore Public Media, which is this station and some other boards. And I know Esther also has served on them. And there's some great advice there. And I agree. Scene Change, kind of tease it up. Scene Change 2 actually gives you some tools to work with the board. Alan, thank you so much for coming back on this. Alan Harrison on the two Scene Change books.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Hi everyone, this is recording artist David Arkenstone, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media 89.1 FM and on WVLP 103.1 FM.
We are pleased to welcome Norbert Shimkus to Art on the Air. Norbert is an award-winning ceramic artist who has had an extensive career in the creative industry, experienced in design, art direction, fashion, and retail. Recently retired, he is focusing on ceramic sculpture and painting. He is currently teaching ceramic character building at the Krazzle Art Center in St. Joseph, Michigan. Two of his sculptures can be seen at the regional exhibition at the Midwest Museum of American Art, where he received an honorable mention award. He also has one sculpture at the community show at the Krazzle. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Norbert. It's wonderful, wonderful seeing you again.
Oh, well, hello. I'm so happy to be here. Well, we're happy to see you again.
Thank you.
Glad to have you part of the show. And of course, our audience always is interested in the background of our guests. I always like to say your origin story. So tell us about how you got from where you were to where you are now.
It's a long, long story, believe
Yay,
me.
Yay, we love long, long, winding stories.
I was born on the southwest side of Chicago many years ago and went to Catholic grade school there and Chicago Public High Schools later on, but was always interested in art and encouraged by art. And I think that was early on, I found that was how I got, you know, attention and noticed and, you know, pats on the back. So from a very early age, that was became my niche. One of my favorite stories.
Were you drawing?
Oh yeah, mainly, you know, it was basic stuff, you know, paintings and drawings, nothing sculptural really until much later. One of my favorite stories was in grammar school. It was like art day on a Friday afternoon. And because I was a little, I think, shyer or in the back of the class, when the pastel box was passed around, all I had were the really odd colors, like these purples and grays. And it wasn't like the blues and greens and the primaries that you would think to draw a landscape with. So I did the best I could. And it turned out, you know, quite impressionistic, wonderful. And the one art teacher said, "Oh my God, like, this is the one kid who didn't use blue for a sky." And so quite by chance, I got noticed, you know, doing artwork that way. And then, you know, you become the art kid in school. Like, you're known for that. And you just keep going, winning, you know, the little awards along the way. So, and then in high school, same thing. Quickly got involved with, you know, the drama club and the newspaper and the arts club, and just had a great time doing as much as I could. And, you know, once again, getting noticed and enjoying it, and just enjoyed making art and making people, you know, happy from that aspect.
So in high school, what other disciplines were added? Did you have sculpture? Did you have ceramics? Did you have metalsmithing, or was it primary?
No, this was, it was like Chicago Public High School. And although they had a very nice program, it was limited as what supplies we had. So it was mainly drawing, painting, and printmaking. We did have, you know, block printing, and we had a very simple printing press, but our school did not have any kind of a kiln or anything for advanced arts. You know, we did okay. I mean, I still had a great time with it. And yeah, and just we had some really great teachers who were encouraging. Like when I was a senior and like my parents wanted me to become an accountant, like you needed, it's, you know, that generation where you should be something, yes, you know, serious and make money. And, you know, the one teacher did like call my mother and say, you know, Norbert really has a creative gift and you should encourage that. Not that they didn't encourage it. They were very encouraging, but as far as a career, they thought, you know, he thought I had something that I could make a career at it. So.
And did your parents heed that?
Yeah, no, they were great. I mean, luckily I was able to get a job after college, you know, at an advertising agency. So I was able to support myself relatively quickly after that. But after high school, I did go to college, Illinois State in Normal, Illinois, and majored in art with an emphasis in graphic design, because kind of in the back of my mind, I always knew I had to make a living somehow. So did that, came up with a decent portfolio, joined the school paper, which was a daily newspaper called The Vedette. Wow. And that experience, like churning ads out every day, was really a great one as far as technical things and working with the deadline, working with clients. And that helped me bring a portfolio after college that got me a job in Chicago doing key line and paste up in an art department. So
I went in high school, you mentioned drama. Were you acting? Were you behind the scenes?
No, always behind the scenes. one of those like weird stories. In French class, we were asked to make masks for Mardi Gras. So I did a beautiful mask. The drama teacher walked by and said, "Oh my God, we need masks for the king and I. We're doing, you know, the Uncle Tom's Cabin scene for the king and I, and we need masks for the dancers. Would Norbert be available?" So I was like, sure. So I got hooked at the drama club that way, and then spent the next 4 years designing scenery and lighting for the productions. And just, you know, once again, love that, and became like the head of the scenic department by the time I was a senior in high school.
Props master.
Oh, there
yeah,
you go.
Exactly. Love being behind the scenes. Not very good at being in front of on the stage.
Yeah, that's my origin in theater too. I started out as lighting designer and eventually got into directing and producing. But yeah, in school I did that and understand that, you know, and then working also at the school level, I had a lot of kids that I encouraged to be scene designers, stage managers, and all the things, everything besides going. If they want to go into acting and make a career of it, I always have to sit down and talk with them about how tough it is to make a exactly. living.
Yeah, I mean, just the camaraderie of the backstage crew was just so wonderful. And, you know, yeah, some friends I still know, you know, I'm not on Facebook and things. So just, you know, great experience. People always say that they had a rough time in high school. And I said, I had the best time in high school. I was involved in band and newspaper and drama club and just had a wonderful experience.
I always told them, I always told the students, I says, you know, all the classes you took, your math class, everything, go by in a blur, but you'll remember every time you did this in the show or you spilled paint here or everything, it'll be mm-hmm. that. And I just posted a meme on my Facebook page that said that, about the experience of being in theater, music, thing in the arts. And I said, that is sometimes what kids show up for. It's not because of that. That's what makes them come to schools, be part of those types of things. And
exactly.
And, yeah.
Yeah. I agree 100%.
So you got that first job, due to your excellent portfolio. And so where did you go from there?
I mean, back in the day before computers, it was Keyline and Payslip was the traditional entry point into the business. So I did that for maybe 6 months to a year before, you know, the head designer had a little brochure that he didn't want to do and, you know, threw it to the kid in the corner. Like, Nora, what can you do with this two-color brochure? And, you know, so I took it, ran with it, and it, you know, was well received. And then slowly you become a junior designer and a designer and an art director. And I made my career out of it, basically becoming a designer and an art director for ad agencies.
So what's some of the projects you worked on that might be maybe known to our audience?
Yeah, I'm not sure. It was a lot of real estate. So later in my career, I did work for Water Tower Place and 900 North Michigan Shops in Chicago, doing the brand marketing for those shopping centers. I did some of the early work for Blue Chip Casino in Michigan City before it was purchased by Boyd. Archway Cookies, we did some Christmas. It's a real mixed bag.
But then promotions. Chanticleer too, which is so exciting.
Yes, well, that was later. I'm trying to think. Marriott Hotels was on my roster, Budget Rent-A-Car. But then the shopping centers went into, we got some clients out of New York, the shops at Columbus Circle, which was really satisfying. They had nice budgets, good photographers we could use, you know, nice media. It's fun to see your work, you know, plastered across, you know, New York bus stations. And
so was this with your own company or was it with
agency? This is through an agency.
Okay.
All through an agency. And then I freelanced for a while because as the shopping center business, they were cutting back, you know, because obviously, you know, the shopping centers were going the way of the dinosaur and the budgets were the first thing to get cut. So as those got smaller, they didn't need less. So I went freelance and then picked up some clients like Chanticleer and Chicago Acapella just by coincidence. I did a brochure for Chicago Acapella that Chanticleer liked, and they called me, can we just pick up this design and swap out the concerts? I said, well, sure, that's easy enough. So I worked with them for 10 years.
You're a wonderful group.
And you worked with Ford Models doing that and working actually with models for various things.
Oh, so. Yeah. When I was freelancing, through my work as an art director, I got to know, you know, the people at Ford. And then when I went on my own, they said, well, you know, we need art directors for photo shoots as well, not just models. So they had an art director division. So they put me on several photo shoots, working with their clients, with their models. Some of it was fun. Some of it was, you know, pretty, not to say down and dirty, but it was like, you know, the flyer inserts for Sears and Kmart's, you know, where you have 30 models to shoot on one background in one day. And it's, you know, it's like churn and burn kind of stuff. So, it was fun, but busy.
Right. So then you ventured out. I mean, you were freelancing, but you kind of ventured out on your own with your own named design business. Tell us about that transition from just pure freelance to setting that up.
Because I was freelancing, I really just started going after, you know, certain clients. So it's, you know, word of mouth. I didn't really solicit myself to cold calling that much. It was all people who knew me from the business and freelancing through that. And then Another side venture was in the 80s, I took a class in decorative painting in New York City for the Day Studio, because as you know, faux finishing was really becoming popular in the late 80s. So I took classes on that and then had my own business doing decorative finishing for about 3 or 4 years of, you know, lots of sponging and glazing and ramp finishing, as well as marbleizing and gilding and
all of it.
Fun, but got really tired of climbing ladders and
it does get repetitive
and crawling on your back behind someone's toilet, because they always want the powder room to be wonderful.
So Norbert, during this time, did you start your own practice? You know, you're doing other people's homes, but did you have your own personal art practice aside from your work life?
Yeah, I mean, it was always kind of a side interest. I would take adult education classes for the American Academy of Art and watercolor, life drawing. I said at the Palette and Chisel in Chicago. I took some painting classes at Oxbow in Saugatuck through their institute. So that was always kind of a side interest. I wasn't necessarily concerned about, you know, making money at it or making it a business per se, but it was just an interest that I enjoyed pursuing. So now, as you know, always in the back of my mind, it was in my later years when I retired, you know, that was something to have fun with, but not necessarily be burdened by making it a business.
No, personal satisfaction.
Yeah. And, you know, if something sells, that's great. You know, that's wonderful, but it's not necessarily the goal. So whereas in advertising, it's always, you know, the goal is to make a client happy. Now I'm only making myself happy. So.
You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, on WVLP, 103.1 FM. So let's talk about how you made the, going into, and Esther kind of touched on this, but, you know, you're teaching ceramics, but also really doing that with ceramics, sculpture, and your other things. So talk about that, your actual art practice that you are doing as current.
You know, after you take a lot of classes, you learn the basics. So you start realizing, okay, you can only do so much. And then the past maybe 4 years where I've been building without really any, you know, supervision or a teacher looking over my shoulder, it's where I'm kind of, you know, what am I trying to say? What is the reason I'm making this piece? So that's where I keep going back to these characters and faces. It's almost harkening back to my art direction days in the fashion industry, where I was always looking at faces and, you know, picking out the right poses for the emotion. I feel like I'm turning that into my characters that I'm building in clay. So I'm really building a personality and a feeling with my creations. And so really
did you
only
take those first clay classes at the Krazzle, or where did clay come into your life? Because we've been talking about
clay bounced in and out. I took some early classes at Lill Street in Chicago back in the 80s when it was still on Lill Street.
Yes, when it was still on Lill Street.
And there was a wonderful sculptor named Anna Varela, and she had a very fine studio practice, but super realistic and structured, and, you know, taking body measurements. And I took about a year and a half there, and then, you know, got distracted and did something else. I tend to change practices every so often. But then got back into Lill Street maybe 8 years ago. I was just having the urge to get my hands dirty again. And Wayne went to a bar, and the bartender said, was also a sculptor and a ceramicist, said, you should go to Lill Street. There's a great teacher there. And she would, you know, she's wonderful. Robin Power, she's truly an amazing artist. So yeah, I signed up for her class and got back into hand building and fine tuning the techniques that I kind of already knew, but once again, reinforced again. So spent about 6 years there taking different classes, dabbling in the wheel, but not necessarily finding enjoyment in the wheel. It makes me too nervous. But going back to character building. And then when I moved up to Bridgman full time with my husband, discovered the Krazzle Art Center about 3 years ago. And they have a thing called the Clay Guild, where you just pay a quarterly fee and you have access to their studios and kilns and glazes. So it's perfect for the, you know, the artist who doesn't have a home setup, especially a kiln. So actually I can build things at home here and then take them to Krassel for firing and finishing. So it's, and because they wanted to expand upon their hand building and figurative, you know, focus, they're do a lot of, you know, wheel throwing. They asked me just this past summer if I would consider teaching a class, because they see my pieces coming and going, and, you know, very well received. So they said, would you like to teach something this fall? So I've just started doing that this past September.
Are you enjoying it?
Yeah, yeah. I find myself worrying about the students' pieces as much as mine, because it's a smaller class. It's only 8 students, but like, oh, I hope, you know, Becky put her, you know, glazed properly, or, you know, did she do that? I didn't notice it. So I'm relaxing a little bit more now and not taking their work home with me. But so far so good. And it was extended for 4 weeks, and then I'm going to be doing another one in January, I believe. So yeah, it's been very satisfying. And then I also get to do my work as well. So it's a very nice group of people over there. I can't say enough about them.
Yeah, it's a wonderful, Krassel's wonderful.
Yeah, and there's a community show right now. I've got one piece in the community show that just opened up this past weekend and is on display through January 14th of 25, I believe. So,
It's not specifically ceramics, is it?
Oh gosh, no. It's open to all artists in the region. So it's a mixed bag of ceramics, paintings, drawings, sculpture. So, but it's very diverse and very interesting. I just walked through it yesterday. So.
Now, you were talking about possibly exploring other things, is something we always ask our artists on the show. Is there something outside of what you're doing right now that you'd like to explore that you haven't? Maybe move into some sort of painting or something completely different?
Well, as far as ceramics, I would like to do a nice grouping of a theme. I'm exploring just like doing the 12 basic personality types, the caregiver, the nurturer, the jester. I think that'd be a nice, you know, 12 figures, a cohesive presentation to develop. So that's I'm working on that right now, actually. And then painting, I always have a painting in my background too. So I just got commissioned to do some landscapes last year for a friend of mine. So I'm enjoying the freedom that I have now and all the possibilities that are waiting.
I'm very excited about this series because you capture so much expression and life in your ceramics. I'm tingling wanting to see this series happen.
Me too. I can't wait. I feel like I'm giving birth to them in my studio because, you know, I slowly work on the faces and, you know, just it's the subtlety of the human face, you know, just the tilt of an eyebrow can have a total different expression and meaning. So yeah, I get excited about them. I think about them all the time when I'm, you know, just, I got to.
And also your glazing and the palettes that you choose, it's just so warm and inviting. And yet the flip side, they're also kind of eerie and supernatural. So
oh, well, it's thank you like for getting that. That's exactly
wonderful combination.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Yeah, I love the earth tones and the kind of the mystery of the whole piece. Like, does it have a deeper meaning?
Yeah, because the glazing gives you, I mean, that's where you really stop and think about the piece. I mean, you just, they're
good.
Very
I'm glad
attractive.
You're getting that. So hopefully there is more to come.
Good.
Do you have a daily art practice? Do you have like a routine as well? I got to put so many hours in a day, or is it just like, okay, I'm going to do this right now, or... How's
it's kind of always in the back of my mind, and I love that it's in the basement of my home here in South Bend. So I can go down there and at least putter a little bit or take the plastic off and think about it and, you know, spray it down with the water and then maybe spend an hour on it and then, you know, cover it up again. So yeah, I try to work maybe 3 or 4 hours, 3 or 4 days a week. I tend to get distracted after 4 hours and something else is happening and there's laundry or there's, you know,
cute kitties,
kitties to deal with, of course. And we just moved into the house. So there's still walls to paint and shelves to build and things to organize. And so, lots to do, but yeah, I try to, work on my art at least 3 or 4 days a week.
Well, we have a couple minutes left. We want to give you a chance. Do you have any exhibits coming up? I know you're currently at the Midwest Museum. I don't know how much longer you're going to be there, but any exhibits that are coming up down the road here into 2025?
Nothing set yet. The Midwest Museum, I think, is through the holiday season of 24, and then the community show is through mid-January 25. And then I'm just, you know, I think February, March is kind of my nose to the grindstone, produce some work during the quiet season here in the Midwest. So after that, the schedule's open. I do have some of my work can be seen on my Facebook page, is Norbert Shimkus Designs. So I have some, I'm populating some of that, some of my work there. So.
And you don't have a website though. You just have the Facebook.
No, not per se. Like it's not, I'm still trying to figure out if I want to do that or not.
Yeah, it is a lot of work. I mean, I maintain multiple websites, my photography website, the one for the show. So it can be a lot of work if you're doing it.
Yeah,
but there are a lot of tools out there that let you do that. Well, we're about ready to wrap up here and appreciate you coming on the show. That's Norbert Shimkus, extensive career in the creative industry and now is teaching ceramic art at the Crassel. Thank you so much for coming on Art of the Air and sharing your art journey and good luck.
Oh, my pleasure. It's been really fun to meet you both. And thank you for encouraging me. I feel very excited and blessed to be with you. Thank you.
Yeah, it's been a complete pleasure. Thank you so much.
We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art on the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Art on the Air is also heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode. Our spotlight interviews are heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Media. Thanks to Tom Maloney, Vice President of Radio Operation for Lakeshore Public Media, and Greg Kovach, WVLP's Station Manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts. We'd like to thank our current underwriters for Lakeshore Public Media, Macaulay Real Estate in Valparaiso, Olga Patrician, Senior Broker. And for WVLP, Walt Reitinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art in the Air. We rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art in the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. You'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or send us information about your arts, arts-related event, or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck, BRECH.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the Air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show